Reacher? Roscoe said. I got the stuff on Sherman Stoller. She was holding a couple of fax pages, densely typed. Great, I said. Let's take a look. Finley got off the phone and stepped over. State guys are calling back, he said. They may have something for us. Great, I said again. Maybe we're getting somewhere. We all went back into the Rosewood office, spread the Sherman Stoller stuff out on the desk, and bent over it together. It was an arrest report from the police department in Jacksonville, Florida. Blind Blake was born in Jacksonville, I said. Did you know that? Who's Blind Blake? Roscoe asked. Singer, Finley said. Guitar player, Finley, I said. Sherman Stoller had been flagged down by a sector car for exceeding the speed limit on the river bridge between Jacksonville and Jacksonville Beach at a quarter to midnight on a September night 2 years ago. He had been driving a small panel truck 11 miles an hour too fast. He had become extremely agitated and abusive toward the sector car crew. This had caused them to arrest him for suspected DUI. He had been printed and photographed at Jacksonville Central, and both he and his vehicle had been searched. He had given an Atlanta address and stated his occupation as truck driver. The search of his person produced a negative result. His truck was searched by hand and with dogs and produced a negative result. The truck contained nothing but a cargo of 20 new air conditioners boxed for export from Jacksonville Beach. The boxes were sealed and marked with the manufacturer's logo, and each box was marked with a serial number. After being Mirandized, Stoller had made one phone call. Within 20 minutes of the call, a lawyer named Perez from the respected Jacksonville firm of Zacharias Perez was in attendance, and within a further 10 minutes, Stoller had been released. From being flagged down to walking out with the lawyer, 55 minutes had elapsed. Interesting, Finley said. The guy's 300 miles from home. It's midnight, and he gets lawyered up within 20 minutes with a partner from a respected firm. Stoller was some kind of a truck driver, that's for sure. You recognize his address? I asked Roscoe. She shook her head. Not really, she said, but I could find it. The door cracked open, and Baker stuck his head in again. State police on the line, he said. Sounds like they got a car for you. Finley checked his watch, decided there was time before Teal got back. Okay, he said. Punch it through here, Baker. Finley picked up the phone on the big desk and listened, scribbled some notes and granted a thank you, hung the phone up and got out of his chair. Okay, he said. Let's go take a look. We all three filed out quickly. We needed to be well clear before Teal got back and started asking questions. Baker watched us go, called out after us. What should I tell Teal? He said. Tell him we traced the car, Finley said. The one the crazy ex-con used to get down to Morrison's place. Tell him we're making some real progress, okay? This time, Finley drove. He was using an unmarked Chevy identical to Roscoe's issue. He bounced it out of the lot and turned south, accelerated through the little town. The first few miles I recognized as the route down toward Yellow Springs, but then we swung off onto a track which struck out due east. It led out toward the highway and ended up in a kind of maintenance area right below the roadway. There were piles of asphalt and tar barrels lying around, and a car. It had been rolled off the highway, and it was lying on its roof, and it was burned out. They noticed it Friday morning, Finley said. Wasn't here Thursday, they're sure about that. It could have been Joe's. We looked it over very carefully. Wasn't much left to see. It was totally burned out. Everything that wasn't steel had gone. We couldn't even tell what make it had been. By the shape, Finley thought it had been a General Motors product, but we couldn't tell which division. It had been a mid-sized sedan, and once the plastic trim has gone, you can't tell a Buick from a Chevy from a Pontiac. I got Finley to support the front fender, and I crawled under the upside-down hood, looked for the number they stamp on the scuttle. I had to scrape off some scorched flakes, but I found the little aluminum strip and got most of the number. Crawled out again and recited it to Roscoe. She wrote it down. So, what do you think? Finley asked.
Could be the one, I said. Say he rented it Thursday evening up at the airport in Atlanta, full tank of gas, drove it to the warehouses at the Margrave Cloverleaf, then somebody drove it on down here afterward. Couple of gallons gone, maybe 2.5, plenty left to burn. Finley nodded.
Makes sense, he said. But they'd have to be local guys. This is a great spot to dump a car, right? Pull onto the shoulder up there, wheels in the dirt, push the car off the edge, scramble down and torch it, then jump in with your buddy, who's already down here in his own car waiting for you, and you're away. But only if you knew about this little maintenance track, and only a local guy would know about this little maintenance track, right?
He left the wreck there and drove back up to the station house. The desk sergeant was waiting for Finley.
Teal wants you in the office, he said.
Finley grunted and was heading back there, but I caught his arm.
Keep him talking a while, I said. Give Roscoe a chance to phone in that number from the car.
He nodded and carried on to the back. Roscoe and I headed over to her desk. She picked up the phone, but I stopped her.
Give me the gun, I whispered, before Teal is through with Finley.
She nodded and glanced around the room, sat down and unclipped the keys from her belt, unlocked her desk and rolled open a deep drawer. Knotted down to a shallow cardboard box. I picked it out. It was an office storage box about 2 inches deep for holding papers. The cardboard was printed with elaborate wood grain. Someone had written a name across the top. Gray. I tucked it under my arm and nodded to Roscoe. She rolled the drawer shut and locked it again.
Thanks, I said. Now, make those calls, okay?
I walked down to the entrance and levered the heavy glass door open with my back. Carried the box over to the Bentley. I set the box on the roof of the car and unlocked the door. Dumped the box on the passenger seat and got in. Pulled the box over onto my lap. Saw a brown sedan slowing up on the road about 100 yards to the north.
2 Hispanic men in it.
The same car I'd seen outside Charlie Hubbell's place the day before. The same guys. No doubt about that. Their car came to a stop about 75 yards from the station house. I saw it settle, like the engine had been turned off. Neither of the guys got out. They just sat there, 75 yards away, watching the station house parking lot. Seemed to me they were looking straight at the Bentley. Seemed to me my new friends had found me. They'd looked all morning. Now they didn't have to look anymore. They didn't move, just sat there, watching. I watched them back for more than 5 minutes. They weren't going to get out. I could see that. They were settled there. So I turned my attention back to the box. It was empty, apart from a box of bullets and a gun. A hell of a weapon. It was a Desert Eagle automatic. I'd used one before. They come from Israel. We used to get them in exchange for all kinds of stuff we sent over there. I picked it up. Very heavy. 14-inch barrel, more than 1.5 feet long, front to back. I clicked out the magazine. This was the 8-shot 44 version. Takes 8 44 Magnum shells. Not what you would call a subtle weapon. The bullet weighs about twice as much as the 38 in a police revolver. It leaves the barrel going way faster than the speed of sound. It hits the target with more force than anything this side of a train wreck. Not subtle at all. Ammunition is a problem. You've got a choice. If you load up with a hard-nosed bullet, it goes right through the guy you're shooting and probably right on through some other guy 100 yards away. So you use a soft-nosed bullet, and it blows a hole out of your guy about the size of a garbage can. Your choice. The bullets in the box were all soft-nosed. Okay with me. I checked the weapon over. Brutal, but in fine condition. Everything worked. The grip was engraved with a name. Gray, same as the file box. The dead detective, the guy before Finley, hanged himself last February. Must have been a gun collector. This wasn't his service piece. No police department in the world would authorize the use of a cannon like this on the job. Altogether too heavy. I loaded the dead detective's big handgun with 8 of his shells. put the spares back in the box and left the box on the floor of the car. Cocked the gun and clicked the safety catch on. Cocked and locked, we used to call it. Saves you a split second before your first shot. Saves your life, maybe. I put the gun in the Bentley's walnut glove compartment. It was a tight fit. Then I sat for a moment and watched the two guys in their car. They were still watching me. We looked at each other from 75 yards away. They were relaxed and comfortable, but they were watching me. I got out of the Bentley and locked it up again, stepped back to the entrance and pulled the door, glanced back toward the brown sedan. Still there, still watching. Roscoe was at her desk, talking on the phone. She waved, looked excited, held her hand up to tell me to wait. I watched the door to the Rosewood office, hoped Teal wouldn't come out before she finished her call. He came out just as she hung up. He was all red in the face, looked mad, started stamping around the squad room, banging his heavy stick on the floor, glaring up at the big, empty bulletin board. Finley stuck his head out of the office and nodded me in. I shrugged at Roscoe and went to see what Finley had to say. "What was that all about?" I asked him. He laughed. "I was winding him up," he said. "He asked what we'd been doing, looking at a car. I said we weren't. Said we told Baker we weren't going far, but he'd misheard it as we're looking at a car." "Take care, Finley," I said. "They're killing people. This is a big deal." He shrugged. "It's driving me crazy," he said. "Got to have some fun, right?" He'd survived 20 years in Boston. He might survive this. "What's happening with Picard?" I asked him. "You heard from him?" "Nothing," he said. "Just standing by." "No possibility he might have put a couple of guys on surveillance?" I said. Finley shook his head, looked definite about it. "No way," he said. "Not without telling me first." "Why?" "There's a couple of guys watching this place," I said. "Got here about 10 minutes ago. Plain brown sedan. They were at Hubble's yesterday and around town this morning, asking after me." He shook his head again. "They're not Picards," he said. "He'd have told me." Roscoe came in and shut the door, held it shut with her hand like Teal might try to burst in after her. "I called Detroit," she said. "It was a Pontiac, delivered 4 months ago. Big fleet order for a rental company. DMV is tracing the registration. I told them to get back to Picard up in Atlanta. The rental people might be able to give him the story about where it was rented. We might be getting somewhere." I felt I was getting closer to Joe, like I was hearing a faint echo.